Okay, I'd like to read another selection from Kovilo read one a while ago, Ajahn Thun, and I'd like to read Ajahn Kun, who's from, and this is from that book, Ginkan Hengbothian, and these are tentative translations or early translations of a few of them, of the selections. It's called Twigs and Branches of Bodhiyana, and Ajahn Kun is from Wat Pa Po Sawan, which is it's in Ubon province. I think it might be in Warin, sort of on the way out to Ajahn Anaik's, just sort of off that road. Okay. And it comes in questions and answers. Lumpa, how did you come to stay in practice with Lumpa Cha? Before coming to stay at Wat Nongbapong, I was studying for the Nak Tham exams at Wat Luang. A monk from Wat Nak Ge, who was studying together with me there, invited me to go with him on a trip to visit Pratsaya Cave. While we were there, we met a novice who was living there. Having passed all three levels of the Nak Tham exams, he set out on Tudong and had been practicing at the cave for already 2 or 3 years. I asked him why he hadn't ordained as a monk. He responded that to ordain as a monk and keep all the rules is burdensome. Being a novice was easier and he could live alone. I stayed there for 2 or 3 nights. In the middle of the night, I saw that novice walking Jongkong, and I thought, wouldn't it be good if I was able to live like this? This is the way a monk should live. It really made an impact on me. After returning from Patsang Cave, I thought, if I'm going to go off to practice, where should I go? At that time, I thought to go to a place in Emperor Gangkawai, Saratburi province, which is in central Thailand. Then another monk said, why go so far away when Ajahn Chah at Wat Nongbapong is just around the corner? He preaches well, and every day loads of people from the Warin market go there to practice. So I asked that monk to take me there. At that time, I was still using money. On the way, we took a detour to buy some Pepsi at Ban Nong Thapon, and then continued walking on to Ban Gaw. It was April, and construction was being done on the road. At about the time we would normally have our midday meal, we saw some ripe fruit that had fallen along the side of the road, so we picked them up and ate them. As soon as I entered inside, I felt a sense of coolness. I saw a sign reading, Place of Respect, and then I saw the meeting hall. A group of novices made gestures of respect, and I felt that it was strange, because in the city, I never encountered this. I arrived at Lumpa's Kuti and paid respects. He asked about my coming and going, and I told him that I'd like to stay there and be his disciple. He asked what level I had studied to and why I wanted to practice. I responded honestly that I had passed the second level Nak Tham, but was reluctant to continue because I felt my head wasn't good enough. And that's the way the idiom in Thai is Huo Mai Di, but it sort of it didn't feel I was clever enough to do that, get that last degree. On that day, there happened to be a Maha who came to pay respects as well. So Lumpa took us on a tour of the monastery. He told me that if I wanted to practice here, then I should come before the full moon in June. After that would be the time when the monks come back from Tudong, so there wouldn't be any free kutis. I humbly informed him that I would go and take leave from my teacher and then come back right away. So after taking leave from my Upajaya, I came back to Wat Nongbapong to stay. What year was that? 1967. Lumpa Cha spoke with my father, who brought me there, saying, You've taken the turtle and released it at the pond. Lumpo's words really hit the mark. After 15 days, Lumpo Cha had all of my requisites swapped. I remember that it was the Uposatha day. He asked me, how did you acquire your jibon? How about your yam, your shoulder bag? All of your requisites, where did they come from? Any requisites that you bought yourself, you have to relinquish and then confess your offense. I had heard that the use of money wasn't allowed at Wat Bapong, so I didn't take any with me. My jibon and yam were actually donated, but he just had me change everything anyway. At that time, Prat Maha In looked after matters regarding requisites. He arranged for me a new triple set of robes and a large-sized bowl. I was happy beyond words and felt like I had been born anew. Lumpo put me in a tiny kuti in the forest. It was the first time I had stayed in a forest, and I didn't sleep well. I kept alert so that as soon as the bell rang at 3 a.m., I just left my kuti and followed the sound. I stayed on and eventually entered Pansa. Lumpa Ruangrit and Lumpa Sumedho also arrived during that time. There were altogether about 20 to 30 monks for Pansa that year. During Pansa, Lumpa read from the Pupasika and chanted with us every day. Following that year, the numbers increased, and when Lumpa had many burdens, he wouldn't always come. After reading from the Pupasika, he would give a talk until 10 or 11 and then go back to his kuti. If anyone still didn't want to go back to their own kuti, they would persuade one another to take advantage of the special opportunity to be with Lumpa over at his kuti. It was dark, the lanterns wouldn't be lit, and he would tell us about all kinds of things. Most of the knowledge I gained was from those conversations, both methods of practice and insight about myself. At Wat Lom Bapong in those days, we would wash our robes on rotation. One group would wash this week and the other the next. As for things like tea, coffee, and medicinal fruits, samos, we would have them just once every 7 days. On normal days, there wasn't any. We would sweep the monastery once a week, and everyone would do it together. Once the sweeping was done, we would take water from the well and put it into large jars for use. All the monks would help each other, and we were eager. Back then, the water would first be put in buckets, and then two monks would carry it together using a long pole. Later on, we got push carts and plumbing. After the work period, we would gather for the afternoon drink. It seemed so delicious because we were so thirsty, to the point where you wanted as big a cup as you could find. And he laughs. Then it would be time for the evening meeting. This was the normal routine. Lumpo once asked me, what level of the Naktam exams have you finished? I told him the second level. And after that, he asked me, really, when it comes to what can actually be put into practice, you still haven't finished level one. Then he asked, do you know the Apanaka Patibhata? I told him that I couldn't remember. Apanaka Patibhata are the incontrovertible practices, Indriya Sangvara, Bhojane Matanyuta, Chakalayana Yoga, and that devotion to wakefulness, sense restraint, and moderation in eating. I told him that I couldn't remember. Then he said that whether one is past Naktam level 2 or has some other kind of fancy degree is unimportant. His way of training didn't use some kind of method to examine one's mental states in the way others teach meditation these days. He simply speaks Dhamma continually and has us contemplate for ourselves. That's sort of in contrast to the Mahasi Sayadaw technique, which had been was starting to become popular around that time, starting to be introduced, particularly by the administrative monks. He taught the monks and novices to have mutual respect by maintaining the relationship of senior and junior, avuso and bante. Matters of respect are a means of extinguishing the self. The monks and novices of Wat Nongpa Phong were thus easy to manage. I looked up to, respected, and was conscientious of Lumpu, since he was foremost. Back then, Lumpu only needed to supervise himself. Whatever he said, no one would disobey. He just kept himself even and centered, not favoring one person and ignoring another. He had the monks and novices maintain loyalty, respect, and trust. To be together, not suspicious of one another. To be dedicated to the practice, not thinking about anything else. In those times, there wasn't much concern given to matters of building or fine requisites, because he emphasized matters of practice. He said, "Let's just practice well according to Dhamma and Vinaya. No need to worry about going without. Those things will come on their own afterwards." This way of practice seeps into our hearts and minds automatically because we see it with our eyes and hear it with our ears. How many years did you stay with Lumpu Cha? I was only there for one pansa and one hot season. Apart from that, Lumpu sent me to Pudindang, Tamsang Pet, Bunka Luang, or Wat Ba We Wake. Those are all the kind of early main branch monasteries of Wat Pa Phong. Pudindang was Ajahn Maha Surapong, Songpong, Maha Surapong. Anyway, he's very senior. And he had been been a secretary to Somdet in Bangkok. He was very, but he was from the from that Ubon area, and decided to pack in kind of the city life, and came and stayed with Mahasupong, came and stayed with Lumpa Cha. A very lovely demeanor, a very, very good monk. And in Wat Thamsang Phet was Jan Thun, who we read from the other day. And Bunkao Luang is Lumpa Jan, one of the very early disciples. And Wat Ba We Wake is Ajahn Maha Amon, another senior scholar and administrator and teacher of Pali. But I always held, so he sent off to these different places. But I always held him to be foremost and placed my full trust in him. Wherever he told us to go, we just went. No one would disobey like the monks and nuns do these days. When Lopa told me to go and be the abbot of Wat Ba Khaw, one person spoke up and said, Wat Ba Khaw is actually where Ajahn... Do you remember his name? He's a really good monk. He's out. It's oh dear. I'll think of it after the reading. He's somewhat senior to me. When Lumpa told me to go and be the abbot of Wat Ba Khaw, one person spoke up and said, "Ajahn Khun doesn't really speak. Will he be able to do it?" And Lumpu told him, "A pot that isn't struck doesn't make a sound," meaning some people are very capable but don't express it until there is a cause, just as how a pot only makes a sound once it's been struck. There was one time when he came for a special meal offering at Wat Ba Khaw. In the morning, we went on Pindabat. He asked, "Why aren't there many people putting food in our bowls?" I told him that usually there are a lot, but because of the special meal offering, they're probably all getting ready to come to the monastery. Then he said, "That's just making excuses for lay people," and laughing. He would use words to trap us like that. Regarding matters of desire, he taught us, saying, "If you want to go, don't let yourself go. If you want to eat, don't let yourself eat. If you want to lay down, don't let yourself lay down." I contemplated this in this way. If you want to go, following craving and kilesa, don't go just yet. Just watch yourself first. First, let the desire fade. Don't go and follow it just yet. But when there is wanting and hunger, there is dukkha, because these feelings overwhelm us. Back then, we would all eat together following seniority. Once Lumpu had taken his first bit, then the second monk would take his, and then gradually it would go down the line until the last row. This was one way he had us respect one another. Even the novices did it, and no one complained that it was hard or difficult. The food at that time also wasn't very much. There would be a big pot of curry, but because the monks and novices were so many, we'd get only one ladle full per person, and a spoon tip of chili paste dropped into the bowl like gecko poo. But it was delicious. There were also different kinds of vegetables. When the foreigners came, they did the same. They ate sticky rice and fermented fish, just the same. No one got special treatment. That was how Lumpu was capable of killing others' defilements. He didn't let us follow our wishes. If people follow their wishes, you can't teach them. They're no good. Lumpu dared to train us and torture us. Wisdom, panya, then arises on its own. This is hard to do, but he could do it with his disciples. If he had wanted to pamper his disciples, he could have done, but this would have made them stupid. So this was his strategy. I took up the duty of ringing the bell for about 1 month. I would prepare in advance by robing up before going to sleep, because I was worried I wouldn't wake up on time. It would already be past midnight when I went to sleep, and I woke up at 2 a.m., because if I went to sleep too early and then woke up in the middle of the night, it's possible that I could absentmindedly fall back asleep and not get up on time to ring the bell at 3. Once I had finished with this duty, I felt so relieved. He laughs. On one prat, everyone would ne satchik together. Some monks would sneak away to sleep, but they would feel ashamed around their friends. This itself was a reason for staying. After the evening meeting, at about 10 p.m., Lumpu would sit on the Dhamma seat and speak until 12, 1 or 2 or even 3 a.m. Once he was up there, he would talk for a long time, and there wasn't any bathroom breaks. A lot of people would come to listen to his talks on one prat. People would come from the Warren Market, and the sala would be full. We would sit and listen too. Sometimes there was drowsiness, but I considered this practicing the Dutangas. If they could make it all through the night till morning, the monks would boast to one another as though they were competing. If you could really do it, you would feel so glad and motivated, and your rice would taste great. In the past, there weren't any matters from outside coming in to disturb us. Being in the monastery truly felt like being in the monastery. During the pansa, I practiced not looking at people's faces. If I was to let myself look at this and that, then I would be afraid of ruining my virtue, ruining my meditation, afraid that it would deteriorate. So I composed and restrained myself in that way. There was one time when Lumpu Cha took us to send Lumpu Chalui to the train station. Lumpu Chalui was a senior Dhammayut monk that Lumpu Cha lived with for two pansas, which was crowded and chaotic. I kept restraint and composure over my eyes and ears the whole time. That pansa, I felt happy in heart and mind, because I saw that it works. I didn't have any doubts. I didn't think about whether I should go here or there, seek out this Kruba Ajahn or that one, because I thought that what Lumpu had done for us already works. All that's left is that we have to put it into practice ourselves. Question. When Wat Pepong had only 3 branches, how would Lumpu Cha show his support? Back then, there weren't many branch monasteries, just Pudindang, Bunkaluang, and Aranyavasi. After Pawarna and the exiting of the rains, we would all come and gather at Wat Nongpapong. Sometimes during Pansa, he would take 7-day leave to go and visit his branch monasteries. That was his practice. He was truly dedicated in his work of spreading the teaching. However he taught, that's how he was. I have full confidence in Lumpa's way of doing things. I've never been of two minds, never even thought of practicing in any other way. Before I came to Wat Ba Napo, I was at Wat Ba Kho. Ah, yes, here it is. It's the monastery of Ajahn Bunjong, Bakaw. And was thinking of moving to Ban Gang Sea Coat. Lumpu asked me, "Why are you going so far? Why don't you go somewhere near your home village?" I considered this to be him pointing the way, and therefore changed my plans. Before finally coming here, I went to pay respects and take leave of him. Then he asked, "Are you sure it's a good idea to go back to your home village? Suppose your mother and father were to die, would you cry?" I told him, "No, I wouldn't cry, sir." He questioned further, "Why wouldn't you cry?" And I replied in honesty that it is because it is their nature to be this way. He would interrogate us like this as a means of testing our strength of heart. The question? "Paul, how do you understand Lumpu Cha's words? You've taken the turtle and released it at the pond." At that time, Lumpu was speaking with my father. "It means that my father's act of taking me to Wat Pa Pong is correct and appropriate. It is the right place, the right way. Having come to the Kruba Ajahn, if one were to take a turtle and release it on a mound or a hill, that wouldn't be the right place, not the right way. But if one were to take and release it in a pond, then that turtle would be safe. In the past, if we wanted to hear a talk or were hungry for knowledge, we would sneak up close to Lumpu and sit and listen while he was speaking with lay people. He would preach to them, and we would take it for ourselves. When the people would come to him, they would lament about all the hardships and difficulties of the household life. If there were many monks and novices around, he would say, 'Listen up, venerables, this is a serious desana.' He was afraid we weren't interested, that we didn't have wisdom, afraid we would get deluded by the world, seeing the monk's life as only pain and difficulty, and then disrobe to have a house and family. The lay people would come thinking they were going to hear Dhamma from Lumpu, but Lumpu saw it as the people coming to leave some Dhamma for him. This person would leave a little, and that person would leave a little. He would take people's conduct as teachings in themselves. He used the simile of taking some herbs out of the person's pocket and then preparing it as medicine for their disease or illness. I often heard Lumpu speaking about this point. To speak about how much Lumpu put his heart into what he did, in the middle of the night he used to go out and patrol the grounds of the monastery. As for me, I've been at my monastery for many years now and have still never done that kind of thing. All I do is assign work." And he laughs. "Sometimes, while walking Jongkrom outside my kuti in the middle of the night, I would see him inspecting the monks and novices. Once in a while, he would address me, saying, 'Kun is walking Jongkrom, eh?' If he saw any monks or novices not walking Jongkrom or chatting together in a group, the next day he would make it the subject of a desana. For the old generation of Kruba Ajahns who practiced together with Lumpu Cha, the feeling was different than for those who came after. Coming into the sala, one had to be extremely quiet. Walking and sitting, one had to be extremely quiet. When taking off or putting on one's sandals, one couldn't make any noise. You couldn't drop anything. If you made some noise by dropping or knocking something over, he would admonish you immediately. If a bowl was dropped and got a dent, the head of the monk who dropped it would also get a dent. It was only fire. That's how he taught, but these days a monk will drop his bowl and send it rolling and then laugh together with the others in fun. Lumpu wouldn't allow use of fine requisites because the monks didn't yet know how to look after and take care of them. We didn't yet know frugality. He would give us old bowls to use, but monks of the new generation only want things that are new and nice. They don't know a thing. The monks of the older generation and those of the newer generation are thus of a different quality. Back then, he wouldn't let us use detergent or soap. There's no such thing as dish soap in those days. Detergent, it's like washing detergent, like Fab, powdered Fab, that's all there ever was, to clean our bowls. He would give us a mound of leaves that had a strong smell and have us use those instead. He said that detergent corrodes the bowl. The bowls weren't as good as the ones we get these days. And when washing our bowls, we did so by resting them on the tops of our feet. Lumpu didn't get carried away with these kinds of things. When you were newly, this is another question. When you were newly ordained, were you determined not to disrobe? I ordained out of tradition and close to home. I'm from Ban Na Po, Emperor Pibun, Monk Sahan. I was a novice for 2 panchas and then ordained as a monk in 1966. In 1967, after my second pancha as a monk, I came to Wat Nongpa Phong. If you were to ask me then, do you think you will disrobe? I would have responded that I don't think of disrobing because I feel that I've already chosen this path. At that time, I was still basically a kid, but I had already managed to see and experience so much. I felt that being in this monastic form was already good. Seeing people going through birth, aging, sickness, and death, whirling around like that, I became very convinced that I wouldn't go that way. I felt, I've already ordained, and I can bear with it. It's never been something trying or difficult for me. Question. Where have you traveled on Tudong, Paul? Tudong means going on a sightseeing trip, and he laughs. I traveled on Tudong to see Songkram and got malaria. See Songkram, I think it's along the border of Laos, and got malaria. After that, I came back to attend the inauguration of the sala at Wat Thamsaeng Phet. Sometimes I went on Tudong into a large forest and thought, now I will put forth unremitting effort. Then, after only 1 or 2 days, I thought again, if I just go in a little further, it would be even better. So I just kept going in further and further until I hit Vientiane in Laos. There were some years when I would go and stay with Lumpa Jan at Wat Bung Kaluang. He would force us to go and stay in a charnel ground. I once stayed in a charnel ground with Lumpa Son for 7 days. Lumpa Son is a disciple of Lumpa Jan. On the first night, I couldn't sleep. From 11 p.m. to midnight, I waited anxiously, expecting a ghost to come at any moment. I was too afraid even to go out and walk Jonggrom, so I just kept with Butto, Butto. But the feeling wouldn't pass. Then I recollected the Karaniya Metta Sutta, and eventually the fear disappeared. Once we finally left the charnel ground, Lumpa Son asked me, "So, what did you see?" I told him that I didn't see anything. Then he said, "I was having encounters since the first night, but I didn't tell you because I was afraid you'd run away." During the time I was at Ban Suan Kloy, I visited the charnel ground regularly. There was one time, however, that I didn't go because there was a female corpse. I still didn't trust myself. That was the one time that I surrendered. When I was at Ban Nong Kao, during the hot season, I would visit the charnel ground alone. It's not that there wasn't fear. I would go in spite of it, because I wanted experience. However great the extent of my fear, I would turn it into non-fear. At that time, I had ordained for 5 or 6 panchas, so I was looking for experience. If the Krupa Ajahn said to do something, then I wanted to give it a try. Even if I was afraid, I still wanted to do it. Back then, monks would talk with one another about their experiences on Tudong. Who went where? How was their practice? What were the results? They would talk about this. Before Pansa, the heads of all the various branch monasteries would request monks from Wat Nongpa Phong to spend Pansa. We would draw lots and then just go according to that. Question, Pa, have you been at Wat Ban Na Po for a long time? Have there ever been difficulties? I've been here since 1976. And there has never really been any problems. This is because whatever we don't yet know, we don't do. Whatever our Krupa Ajahn didn't do, we don't do. Meaning, we don't try to invent anything outside of what he left behind. So there isn't anything incorrect. We don't condemn the villagers for following their traditions, but we don't go along either. The way I am is to be independent. I don't associate with the village temple. If ever they invite me to go and receive a Sangha Dana, I won't go. It's as though we are far away from each other. I don't have a personality that likes to quarrel with others. I don't criticize or make accusations about others. I also don't have any problems with the monks and novices here. We live together in a way that is blissfully unaware. We understand each other and can chat together. There's nothing extraordinary that goes on, and nothing interferes with the harmony between us and the lay stewards or the nuns. There aren't any problems because we don't do anything risky. Question. May I request Lumpa's Metta to give some closing words of Dhamma? For those who are practitioners, do not seek praise from others. Do not fear criticism. We have done what is good and upright, and we should be confident. There's no need to follow the way of others. This is called the heart of a practitioner. We have a duty to do in our practice, and we do just that. If monks and novices practice following this way, there will be stability and safety. But if we follow the current of the world, we will meet with only confusion and chaos. So, Lupa Khun, so after having read that, is people have probably heard me tell the story of Ajahn Tonglat going to on Pindabat and seeing a pregnant woman on Pindabat receiving food, and then walking past and then saying, stopping and saying, "Oh, there's a really good monk in your stomach there," you know. That's Lumpa Khun, and he was in Pindabat in Napo, in Lumpa Ajahn Khun's home village. There's a story of him going off on his in these remote areas and kept going further and further. There's a period when he was out along the border of Laos, in a very beautiful forest area. And there was a couple of the monks who wanted to go and stay with him. He's always been very quiet, but very diligent. He's not an articulate speaker, but he's a very sincere teacher and a very good example. Anando actually was the one who I think he asked to go and stay with Ajahn Khun out in that area. And Lumpa Cha thought about it for a bit. Said, no. Farangs, none of you can go out there. It's too close to the border. There's too much. That was an area of a lot of communist activity. And Ajahn Cha wouldn't let us go out to... Because some of the branch monasteries were like that. It wasn't a branch monastery, but it was a place that Ajahn Khun was living. Even though he was a really good monk, it was still, Lumpa Cha was, I think, rightfully cautious of letting us go out there. There's also places along the Cambodian border that were similarly, he wouldn't let us go and stay. In the early days, there was still a lot of activity happening. Because the American forces didn't pull out until 1973 or something. There's like 5,000 Air Force personnel in Ubon. It's a fighter bomber base. Ubon is closer to both Hanoi and Saigon than it is to Bangkok. So it was a lot of activity that was going on. Also there was something that he said that stimulated a memory about Lumpa treating everybody the same way, and he said he If he had wanted to pamper his disciples, he could have done that, but this would have made them stupid. There's actually there's a circumstance where Ajahn Sumedho was still the only Farang there, people brought, because there was this American base, and they brought hamburgers and stuff out to Ajahn Sumedho in particular. And Ajahn Chah sort of, you know, probably happened once or twice, and then he told, he said, you know, don't do it anymore. He said, you'll just make him stupid. He said, if he's really going to learn, he's going to have to fit in with everything that's here and learn how to adapt to the circumstances here. That'll make him wise.
Were there short periods of time that you lived with Lumbar Khun?
I never lived with him. I went and visited him on quite a few occasions, and he was very supportive of us as Westerners and practitioners. He was very good. He was also very supportive of Wat Khu and when Ajahn Puriso was there. I've never really lived with him practicing there. I've been there many times. I've taken the time to take monks to go and pay respects to him, because he's one of the monks that teachers that the Western monks feel kind of an affinity for and comfortable with. He's a good teacher. Okay, why don't we just sit quietly for a bit?